Welcome to the Buddha Sasana Podcast. This talk was given by Bhikkhu Chintita in Austin, Texas.
Last week, we began recounting the life of the Buddha as pieced together from the earliest texts. We learned of his privileged upbringing, his training under two meditation masters, his practice of strict austerities, his discovery of the middle way, and his awakening at the age of 35. Setting the wheel of Dhamma in motion. The Buddha seems at first not to have been committed to the role of teacher. Assessing the profundity of what he had experienced, he doubted that others would grasp what he might teach. This Dhamma that I have attained is deep, hard to see, hard to realize, peaceful, refined, beyond the scope of conjecture, subtle, to be experienced by the wise. But this generation delights in attachment, is excited by attachment, enjoys attachment. For a generation delighting in attachment, excited by attachment, enjoying attachment, conditionality and dependent co-arising are hard to see. This state, too, is hard to see. The resolution of all formations, the relinquishment of all acquisitions, the ending of craving, dispassion, cessation, nibbana. And if I were to teach the Dhamma, and if others would not understand me, that would be tiresome for me, troublesome for me. Perhaps he thought a life of meditative ease would be preferable, where we might expect an inner dialogue to ensue, Brahma Sahap Sampi, an eavesdropping deity, took up the cause in favor of teaching, showing now appropriate veneration, for deities are never introduced in the early Buddhist texts as objects of worship, but rather to venerate the Buddha and often other Buddhist monastics. The deity knelt down, bowed to the new Buddha, and said, "Lord, let the fortunate one teach the Dhamma. Let the Tathagata teach the Dhamma. There are beings with little dust in their eyes who are falling away because they do not hear the Dhamma. There will be those who will understand the Dhamma." On reflection, the Buddha discovered some truth in the deity's words. The Buddha at first thought to teach the Dhamma to his former teachers, but they had both died. So he decided to seek out the five ascetics who had abandoned him in a huff when he had begun to eat luxuriously, according to newly discovered middle way principles. On the way thither, he encountered another ascetic, Upaka, of the Ajivaka school, who recognized something special in this monk's demeanor. "Clear, my friend, are your faculties, pure your complexion and bright. On whose account have you gone forth? Who is your teacher? In whose Dhamma do you delight?" To this, the Buddha explained that he had no teacher, but was fully awakened through his own efforts. He was, indeed, just now on his way to turn the wheel of Dhamma and beat the drum of the deathless. Upaka's response was a bit disappointing. May it be so, my friend. Shaking his head and taking a side road, Upaka departed. Having botched his first awakened encounter with another ascetic, then having walked for many days, the Buddha found his five former friends at Varanasi in Deer Park in Isipatana. They too noticed something special about their former colleague, something that wasn't there before, aside from weight gain. The Buddha declared, The Tathagata friends is an arahant, rightly self-awakened. Lend ear, friends, the deathless has been attained. I will instruct you. I will teach you the Dhamma. Practicing as instructed, you will in no long time reach and remain in the supreme goal of the holy life for which clansmen rightly go forth from home into homelessness, knowing and realizing it for yourselves in the here and now. And then the Buddha began his very first Dhamma talk, the first turning of the wheel of Dhamma. First, he explained the middle way to justify his luxury. There are these two extremes that are not to be indulged in by one who has gone forth. Which two? That which is devoted to sensual pleasure with reference to sensual objects, base, vulgar, common, ignoble, unprofitable, and that which is devoted to self-affliction, painful, ignoble, unprofitable. Avoiding both of these extremes, the middle way realized by the Tathagata, producing vision, producing knowledge, leads to calm, to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, to nibbana. Then he enumerated the Noble Eightfold Path. And what is the middle way realized by the Tathagata? That producing vision, producing knowledge, leads to calm, to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, to nibbana. Precisely this Noble Eightfold Path, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. This is the middle way realized by the Tathagata, that producing wisdom and producing knowledge leads to calm, to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, to nibbana. The Noble Eightfold Path was the master checklist for all advanced practice that, when taken up with diligence, ensures progress toward awakening. The Buddha then discussed the Four Noble Truths. Now this, monks, is the noble truth of suffering. Birth is suffering, aging is suffering, death is suffering, sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair are suffering. Association with the unbeloved is suffering. Separation from the loved is suffering. Not getting what is wanted is suffering. In short, the five aggregates of attachment are suffering. And this, monks, is the noble truth of the origination of suffering. The craving that makes for further becoming, accompanied by passion and delight, relishing now here and now there. Namely, craving for sensual pleasure, craving for becoming, craving for becoming other. And this, monks, is the noble truth of the cessation of suffering, the remainderless fading and cessation, renunciation relinquishment, release, and letting go of that very craving. And this, monks, is the noble truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of suffering. Precisely this noble eightfold path, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. At the core of the Four Noble Truths is the principle of conditionality. Since that arises, this arises. Since that ceases, this ceases. Conditionality is the foundation of most of Buddha's thinking. Here, as elsewhere, what the Buddha presents initially as a concise statement unfolds into something much more complex in practice. Suffering and craving are prominent, conditionally related mental factors that provide initial points of investigation for the Buddhist practitioner. With the offering of this one discourse, one of the five ascetics, whose name was Kondanya, attained the vision of Dhamma, a brief view of the deathless, an insight that marks one as a stream enterer, ideally fit to embark firmly on the path with no going astray. We will have more to say about the vision of Dhamma and stream entry in later talks. It was at that moment of insight also that the Sangha, the Buddhist monastic community, arose with the first adept monastic disciple. It is said that the Buddha awakened at the age of 35 and died at the age of 80. He taught for the intervening 45 years. The remaining talks in this series describe the core of what he taught over those years. We have abundant reports of the discourses he delivered to diverse audiences in diverse locations on the Gangetic Plain, venues that he reached by foot, wandering from place to place, generally in the company of disciple monks, living on alms, often living in monasteries, land donated by kings or wealthy donors, and developed for habitation for monks. The Buddha is particularly renowned for his unique skill as a teacher, as is abundantly evident in the earliest discourses. Particularly noteworthy are his many apt metaphors and similes, often tuned specifically to his target audience to convey quite vividly some very subtle or sophisticated realization, and his common technique for teaching those trained in non-Buddhist systems by initially adopting their perspective, but then reinterpreting their terminology, thereby subverting them in the direction of more useful views or practices. We will see examples of these in the course of these talks. The Buddha is reported to have been remarkably skilled in shining the light of Dhamma in the most unlikely corners. A great example was his conversion of the mass murderer Angulimala, whom the Buddha apparently sought out for just that purpose. Angulimala later became an arahant. His preferred target audience would be those profoundly dedicated to spiritual development, of great aptitude and dedication, willing and able to give up all other significant assets and responsibilities in order to practice 24/7. Nuns and monks remain the Buddha's focus throughout his teaching career. Nonetheless, progress toward awakening comes incrementally, and each step forward entails some share of the benefits of awakening. Long before full awakening, our life becomes ever less of a problem, We become kinder, more compassionate, calmer, sustained increasingly by an inner strength independent of external contingencies, and we become more balanced in our judgments and more penetrating in our insight. In short, we become more content, happier, wiser, and much nicer to be around. With time, the Buddha broadened the goal, without sacrificing depth, to provide guidance for those who do not fit the ideal profile, in order to ease the harshness of the human condition rather than transcend it. For these, he also provided wise advice on how to live a conventional life with dignity and with virtue. He was comfortable moving through every level of society, speaking with paupers, lepers, with those suffering calamities, with Brahmins, merchants, and with kings and ministers. On an early visit to his hometown of Kapalavastu, his wealthy father was aghast at seeing him walking through the streets of the city collecting alms. Another account has him spending the night in a barn with the permission of a farmer to be joined by another itinerant Buddhist monk who had never met him and had no idea who he was until after long Dhamma discussion. The Buddha also moved about in high social circles. King Bimbisara, in whose kingdom Gotama had awakened, became, it is said, a stream enterer upon hearing a discourse by the Buddha, and then became a major benefactor of the Sangha. King Pasenadi of Kosala became a disciple of the Buddha and visited the Buddha daily when the Buddha was nearby, often asking advice on matters of state. A banker from Sawati, the capital of Kosala, Anattapindika, became a disciple and a stream enterer and donated land to the Sangha, which then became the Buddha's primary residence for the yearly 3-month rains retreat in the years to come, and the most frequent site of the Buddha's discourses. Establishing the Sangha. The Buddha was a threefold genius. First, he became awakened without dependence on a teacher to explain the path to awakening. Second, he succeeded in describing, explaining, illustrating, and elaborating the path he had discovered so that many hundreds of his disciples were able to realize his awakening during his lifetime. Third, he succeeded in perpetuating his teachings and their practice so that future generations might realize awakening and that still others would share the civilizing effects of their awakening. Thereby, the Buddha created not only a path to awakening, but a culture of awakening. He founded an institutional structure that has perpetuated awakening up to the present day. The community of the Buddha's most dedicated disciples seems to have grown by leaps and bounds beyond the original five. A wealthy young man named Nyasa, who was disenchanted with dancing girls and otherworldly pleasures, showed up, his father in hot pursuit. As a result, Nyasa became a monk and then an arahant, and his father a stream enterer and the very first lay follower of the Buddha. Soon the Buddha was off to visit the three Kassapa brothers, matted hair ascetics, who among them had 1,000 followers. Convincing the eldest of the brothers, who had fancied himself already awakened, that he was not, he, his brothers, and their whole complement of followers became disciples of the Buddha. Upetissa and Kolita were ascetics and best friends since childhood. Searching for the deathless, they agreed that whichever found the path thereto would immediately inform the other. One day, Upetissa noticed a lone ascetic gathering alms, whose comportment so impressed him that he suspected some degree of attainment must lay behind. In fact, this ascetic was Asaji, one of the Buddha's first five awakened disciples. Upetissa approached Asaji to inquire about who his teacher might be and what he taught. Asaji named the recluse Gotama of the Sakyan clan and summarized his teachings in a single verse. Of those things that arise from a cause, the Tathagata has told the cause, and also what their cessation is. This is the doctrine of the great recluse. This is a brief statement of this very principle of conditionality. Immediately, Upetissa attained to the vision of Dhamma, thereby achieving stream entry. Later that day, Upetissa repeated this verse to Kolita with exactly the same effect. Upetissa and Kolita would soon achieve the deathless and indeed became the two leading disciples of the Buddha and be known respectively as Sariputta and Moggallana. The Buddha had been planting seeds in fertile fields. With time, however, the quality of his many new monastic disciples began to slack off, to become more like arid or rocky patches of land, sometimes falling into actions and speech that caused others harm and disrupted the harmony of the Sangha, that were inconsistent with a life of renunciation and simplicity, or that reflected poorly on the entire Sangha in the public eye. In response, the Buddha began tightening up, in very explicit ways, the parameters of the monastic life, sometimes in response to complaints from lay people, for he understood, as practical matters, that the Sangha was critically dependent on the goodwill of the laity, and that the laity took inspiration from the Sangha. The full set of monastic rules is called in Pali the Patimokkha. The Patimokkha, supplemented by procedures for governance within the Sangha, along with supplementary discussion and narration, became Vinaya, the full monastic code of discipline. Although there were monastics in India before the Buddha, among all of the bodies of renouncers, it was only the Buddhists who invented monastic life, that is, who provided an organized institution capable of sustaining its teachings. The Buddha himself consistently referred to the body of his teachings as Dhamma Vinaya. It's not often appreciated that institutionalizing the Sangha in this way was a truly monumental achievement. It has been observed that the Buddhist Sangha is likely the oldest human organization in continual existence on the planet. If the Buddha were to return to modern times, he would recognize the Sangha. So enduring is it. This amazing institution, democratic and decentralized, is the product of one genius who cobbled it together from diverse elements already present in ascetic life in his time, who clearly articulated for it a mission and a charter, and who released it into the world, never yet to perish. 5 years after the beginning of the monk Sangha, the Buddha also established a nun's bhikkhuni sangha, roughly equivalent to the monk sangha. The Buddha seems to have had the highest regard for women's potential for awakening, and the many recorded awakened bhikkhunis bear this out. Indeed, a number of nuns became prominent teachers whose discourses are found alongside the Buddhas and Sariputtas in the earliest sources. Aftermath. The sasana, teaching, but often translated as dispensation, is the living Buddhist tradition viewed from a social or historical perspective. Many of his closest disciples met shortly after the Buddha's death in order to recite together the discourses of the Buddha and the Vinaya from memory, in order to ensure uniformity of what would be preserved in memory for future generations. We know a lot about the teachings as they existed during this early period, either as spoken by the Buddha himself or as reworked or augmented by his closest disciples, before the development of separate sects, which developed largely as a result of geographical dispersion. We know because separate sects accurately preserved early teachings even as they added new texts. The primary sources we have of early Buddhism are largely parallel collections of early discourses, which are Dhamma talks of the Buddha and his contemporary disciples, transmitted through different later sects. The Pali Nikayas are preserved in an early Indic language. The Chinese Agamas are translations into Chinese of texts originally transmitted to China through various South Asian and Middle Asian sects in a variety of languages, commonly through classical Sanskrit. In addition, the early Buddhist monastic code, the Vinaya, exists in several parallel versions, preserved and studied in diverse sects. The close agreement among equivalent texts transmitted through distinct sects makes it clear that, for the most part, the teachings of early Buddhism have been accurately and uniformly preserved. About two centuries after the Buddha, the Mauryan Empire had extended its boundaries to encompass an area larger than present-day India, and its emperor, Asoka, became a great promoter of Buddhism in true Buddhist style without neglecting other religious and philosophical traditions. Asoka endeavored to run his empire according to Dhammic principles, caring for the poor, for travelers, for the sick, in what was probably the first known welfare state. He also sent monks as missionaries to far-flung places, even as far as the Mediterranean, in many of which Buddhism took root. In the following centuries, the Buddhist movement spread westward as far as Persia, eastward into Indochina and Indonesia, northward into Central Asia, and from there eastward into China and the rest of East Asia.